Rob Bell has a great new book out called What is the Bible? And I'd like to share a chapter out of this book because it has just inspired me. It has lit a fire under me, and I'm just so excited about what Rob Bell has put together. I want to share a chapter in the book titled Son. From Genesis 22, then God said to Abraham, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah and sacrifice him there. What kind of God would ask a man to sacrifice his son? That's the question about Genesis 22, isn't it? And to get to the answer, we'll need to first spend some time on the history of religion. Then we'll notice a few details in the story, and then we'll answer that question. The history of religion, then, in one paragraph. Early humans came to the realization that their survival as a species was dependent on things like food and water. And for food to grow, it needs sun and water in proper proportion. Too much water and things wash away. Not enough and plants die. Too much sun and plants wilt. Not enough sun and they die as well. These basic observations brought people to the conclusion that they were dependent on unseen forces they could not control for their survival, which was naturally a monumental leap at that time. The belief, and I use that word intentionally, arose that these forces are either on your side or they're not. Your crops grow or they don't. You'll be able to have kids or not. Your animals stay healthy or not. And how do you keep these forces on your side? The next time you have a harvest, you take a portion of that harvest and you offer it on an altar as a sign of your gratitude. Because you need the forces, gods, goddesses, divine beings, on your side. Now imagine what happened when people would offer a sacrifice, but then it didn't rain, or the sun didn't shine, or their animals still got diseases, or they were unable to have children. Obviously, they concluded they didn't offer enough. And so they offered more, and more, and more. Because religion had built into it from the very beginning something called anxiety. You never knew where you stood with the gods. The gods are angry, the gods are demanding, and if you don't please them, they will punish you by bringing calamity. But what if things went well? What if it rained just the right amount, and the sun shone just the right amount? What if it appeared that the gods were pleased with you? Well, then, you'd need to offer them thanks. But how would you ever know if you properly showed them how grateful you were? How would you know if you'd offered enough? If things went well, you never knew if you'd been grateful enough and offered enough. And if things didn't go well, clearly you hadn't done enough. Anxiety, I'd blame. Now, stay with me here, because this is where things get dodgy. Whether things went well or not, the answer was always sacrifice more. Give more, offer more. Because you never knew where you stood with the gods. And so you'd offer part of your crop, and you'd offer a goat, maybe a lamb, maybe a cow, maybe a few cows, maybe some birds. The very nature of early religion is that everything escalated because your anxiety to please the gods, you kept having to offer more. And that's what's most valuable. The most valuable thing you could offer the gods to show them how serious you were about earning their favor. What's the most valuable thing you could offer? A child, of course. Can you see how child sacrifice lurks on the edges of the Old Testament? It's where religion took you, to the place where you'd offer that which was most valuable to you. Now, to the Abraham story. When God tells Abraham to offer his son, he is shocked. It says early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. Abraham gets right to it. He doesn't argue. He doesn't protest. He doesn't drag his feet. He doesn't even ask for instruction. He clearly knows what to do. And so he does it. Of course, that's how Abraham understood the way the world worked. The gods demanded that which was most valuable to you, and if you didn't give it, you'd pay the price. That's how people saw things at that time. So Abraham sets out and reaches the place on the third day. For 3 days, he and his son travel. 3 days in which his son is as good as dead. When they get to the mountain, what does Abraham say to the servants? Come on now, you know this. Right? What does Abraham say to the servants? Actually, I wouldn't know it either if I hadn't read it. He says to them, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we'll come back to you. What? Abraham is going to offer his son, right? That's what the story is about, correct? God telling Abraham to offer his son, and so he does it, or at least proves that he would do it. That's the point, isn't it? But what Abraham says to the servant is that he's going to go over there to offer his son and then come back with his son. All the lights on your dashboard should be blinking by now. There is something else going on in this story, just below the surface. The story is subverting itself, begging you to see something far more significant going on. As they walk up the mountain, Isaac asks Abraham, where's the sacrifice going to come from? This is really kind of morbid, isn't it? As many have understood the story, he's going to his death because his dad loves God so much. Please tell me you find that utterly repulsive. I remember a well-known preacher telling me that when his son was a teenager, he took him up on a hill and read him this story. And then the preacher told his son that he would always love God more than the son. He told me this story like it was an admirable thing he did to teach his son about devotion to God. Rob Bell says, I wanted to throw up. But we've already seen Abraham tip his hat that something else is up. So we're not buying that angle at all. Abraham's answer, God will provide. Clever. It's a non-answer answer. Abraham is in on the joke, or whatever it is you'd like to call it. And then Abraham gets ready to offer his son. But he doesn't, because God stops him. And then God offers a ram instead in the story. Except that it isn't. An angel shows up and says that Abraham is going to be blessed, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed. So, back to our original question. What kind of God would ask a man to sacrifice his son? Now, an answer. Not this one. The other gods may demand your firstborn, but not this God. So if God doesn't want Abraham to offer his son, why the charade? Several responses. First, the drama is the point. Abraham knows what to do when he's told to offer his son because this is always where religion at that time heads. So at first, this God appears to be like all the other gods. The story is like the other stories about God demanding acts of devotion and obedience. Gods who are never satisfied. The first audience for this story would have heard this before. It would have been familiar to them. But then it's not. The story takes a shocking turn that comes out of nowhere. This God disrupts the familiarity of the story by interrupting the sacrifice. Picture an early audience gasping. What? This God stopped the sacrifice? The gods don't do that. Second, the God in this story provides. Worship and sacrifice was about you giving to the gods. This story is about this God giving to Abraham. A God who does the giving. A God who does the providing. This was a new idea at this time in history. Mind-blowing. Groundbreaking. A story about a God who doesn't demand anything, but instead gives and blesses. Third, Abraham is told that God is just getting started. And that this God is going to bless Abraham with such love and favor that through Abraham, everybody on earth is going to be blessed. This God isn't angry, isn't demanding, isn't unleashing wrath. This God has intentions to bless everybody. Not just people who love and obey and offer sacrifices to this God. This God intends to bless all people everywhere. And what is required of Abraham? Trust, faith, belief. No sacrifice needed. Just the belief that this God can be trusted. The story of Abraham continues. A few generations later, we read in Genesis chapter 28 of Abraham's grandson, Jacob. Beginning in the 10th verse of Genesis 28, Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. He reached a certain place and spent the night there. When the sun set, he took one of the stones at that place and put it near his head. Then he lay down there. He dreamed and saw a raised staircase, its foundation on earth, and its top touching the sky. And God's messengers were ascending and descending on it. Suddenly, the Lord was standing on it and saying, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will become like the dust of the earth. You will spread out to the west and the east and the north and the south. Every family on earth will be blessed because of you and your descendants. I am with you. I will protect you everywhere you go, and I will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done everything that I have promised you." When Jacob woke from his sleep, he thought to himself, "The Lord is definitely in this place, but I didn't know it." He was terrified and thought, "This sacred place is awesome. It's none other than God's house and the entrance to heaven." After Jacob got up early in the morning, he took the stones that he had put near his head, set it up as a sacred pillar, and poured oil on the top of it. He named that sacred place Beth-El, though Luz was the city's original name. Jacob made a solemn promise, saying, "If God is with me and protects me on this trip I'm taking, and if God gives me bread to eat and clothes to wear, and if I return safely to my father's household, then the Lord will be my God. This stone that I've set up as a sacred pillar will be God's house, and of everything you give me, I will give you a tenth back." This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. As we read earlier from Rob Bell, the Abraham story is filled with new ideas about God. It represents a dramatic shift within human understanding of God, with the way humans thought about God. It's a key place in the revelation of God to humanity. We always think of Jesus as the clearest and most central person in whom God is revealed, and that is so true. But even as we lift up Jesus, we must never forget how earth-shattering and mind-blowing the revelation of God was during the time of Abraham. People had never conceived of a God like the one revealed to Abraham. A God who did not demand sacrifice like other gods. A God who gives rather than takes. A God who provides. A God who is not simply a force to be appeased. A God who blesses all people everywhere. And most especially, a God who can be trusted to do exactly as He said. People during this time had never conceived of a God like that. They had never known a God like that. Through Abraham, God revealed something new about who God is, who God was, who God will be. Can you imagine how long it must have taken for this new idea to sink in to all the people at that time? Can you imagine how difficult it must have been to try and convince people that this is who God really was, when everything that they saw and around them spoke to the contrary? Can you imagine how much pushback Abraham had to have dealt with when Abraham's going around trying to say, no, God's not that way, God is this way. It's like trying to convince people that the earth is round, not flat, without any pictures from space, right? With all this, surely you can imagine that two generations after Abraham, folks are still struggling to accept and comprehend this amazing new revolutionary idea about God. Most especially, Abraham's grandson, Jacob. I imagine that Jacob was that kid with the eccentric grandpa who thinks that God is on his side, that crazy old codger who actually believes that God's going to make a nation of him. Yeah, right, the people have to be saying. I can imagine that Jacob got picked on by friends and acquaintances in the community around him. Crazy old Abe's grandson, probably going to just grow up and be like his pa Isaac, who's just like his grandpa. Truth is, that family's going nowhere fast. Jacob might have a bit of a rebellious tendency. So many kids do when living in the shadow of an eccentric relative. Perhaps, just perhaps, Jacob would distance himself from his ancestral beliefs so that he didn't look as crazy as the rest of his family. Not trusting this God who his grandpa talked about. In fact, acting out a little bit just to distance himself from those beliefs so that folks in the community would see he was not like them, the rest of his family. That he wasn't crazy. He wasn't odd. He wasn't different. No, he was just like everybody else. He fit in even when the rest of his family did not. Like everyone else around, Jacob knew that God didn't give freely, that extreme sacrifice was demanded, but certainly not a guarantee of getting anything from God. That old tall tale that his grandpa told about God providing an animal for him to sacrifice instead of Jacob's dad Isaac, well, that was just that. A tall tale, a dream, a hallucination, but certainly not real. So perhaps we can also imagine that Jacob might not be as predisposed to accepting the alleged promises of God as told by Grandpa Abe. Perhaps he didn't care to see his family name continue down this crazy path. Perhaps he wanted to redeem that family name, to make a better life for himself in the community. And every good intention is behind all that. It's probably why the Bible first described Jacob as perfect and upright, despite how callous and manipulative Jacob looks when we read the story today. Right? He steals his brother's birthright. Steals his brother's blessing. Doesn't look like a perfect and upright young man. Jacob was doing exactly what his culture and what his society would expect him to do for his family. Make the family name good. Get them away from all this crazy God of grace talk. Back on track like everyone else. So Jacob takes the family blessing, takes the birthright, and seemingly sets out to steer his family back on a normal path, more socially and culturally acceptable. But then God appears in a vision. A vision of a ladder stretching from earth to heaven, and there's God's promises that God speaks during this vision, promises to give Jacob land and generations of children and blessings. Most especially, there's the promise that God will be with him wherever he goes, that God will bring him back no matter what happens to fulfill the blessings God promised. You have to imagine what Jacob must have been thinking, given his crazy family history. oh gosh, now it's happening to me. I'm going crazy too, just like old Grandpa Abe. I can't deny what just happened, but I can't accept it either because it's just going to drag the family down more. I've worked so hard to restore my family name, to get our life back in the good graces of the community. What am I to do? So Jacob takes a middle road. He neither accepts this unconditional promise from God at face value, nor does he run from it. He simply does what any reasonable person would do. Okay, God, I'll trust you if you prove it to me. You take care of me. You provide for me. You make peace in my family despite what I've stolen. And if you do all that, God, then I'll accept you as my God. Heck, I'll even give you a tenth of everything I have. It's not exactly receiving God's grace, is it? It's an if-then response. It's a prove-it-to-me response. God offers grace. Jacob responds with conditions. But the story doesn't end there. Fast forward 20-some years. Jacob returns home, now with a wife, Leah, and another wife, Rachel, and his family, and he's a changed man. God did exactly what God promised to Jacob without conditions. And God's promises have an effect upon Jacob. And all we have to do to see that effect is to read the prayer that Jacob offers when he returns home. When he returns home afraid of his brother Esau, not knowing what Esau is about to do. If you remember the story, he sees Esau with 400 men. Jacob gets a little scared. He has no idea of the amazing grace that he's about to be offered by the brother from which he stole from. So in his fear, Jacob prays a prayer found in Genesis chapter 32. O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred, and I will do you good. I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to me, your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I've become two companies. Deliver me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I am afraid of him. He may come and kill us all. Mothers with the children. Yet you have said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted because of their number. In this prayer, there's no if, then. There's acceptance. There's a recognition of grace and love and faithfulness of God. There's humility. There's an acknowledgement of utter unworthiness. And there is trust in God's promises. God's gracious promises and God's faithfulness in fulfilling those promises transforms Jacob. Transform him from a rebellious, unbelieving youth who tries to steer his family back from crazy to normal into a man who accepts God's grace. A man who founds a nation. A man who realizes that his grandpa was right all along. A man who finally on his deathbed in Genesis 48 claims the God of crazy old Abe and Pa Isaac as his God. The God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day. Friends, we struggle to accept God's unconditional grace every day. We rebel and we try to put conditions on God's grace so that we can say clearly who is right and who is wrong, who believes and who does not, who is living godly and who is not, who gets in heaven and who does not, who is Christian and who is not. But God doesn't work that way. Thousands of years ago, God spoke to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob to show the world who God really is. A God who loves unconditionally. A God who provides. A God who gives without taking. A God who is present without sacrifices. A God who is good. And we, like Jacob, are prone to rebelling against such an unconditional, benevolent, inclusive, and loving God. You see, people all around us right now are proclaiming a God who is full of wrath, who will send you to a torturous hell if you do X, Y, or Z, rather than proclaiming the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, who promises to be with us no matter what we do. A God who promises to save us despite how much we rebel and put conditions on things. A God who promises to be present with us no matter where we leave. A God who promises to make something of us, of you. A God who promises to do good in our lives without condition, no matter how much we may forsake that God, may forsake one another. The God of crazy old Grandpa Abe, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob is radical, hard to believe, hard to accept in a world that's based on conditions and contracts, and if you do this, then I'll do that. But the good news is that God's promises remain, despite our lack of faith, despite our lack of trust, despite our actions, God's promises remain. And God's promises will change us. God's promises will change each of us. Just like they changed Jacob. They will save each of us. Just like they saved Jacob on that day long ago when his brother Esau ran up to him and gave him a big old hug and said, "Don't worry. My love for you is greater than anything you could have done." God's promises will win in the end until we all proclaim that God is our God and God has been our shepherd all our lives. Let it be so.